CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 159, with Dr. David Gunn, a fellow ophthalmologist in Australia who's teaching himself the newest techniques. You can do this too.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. David Gunn from Brisbane. And he's a cornea cataract refractive surgeon and has really taught himself a lot about surgery, but also AI. And we're going to get into all those details today. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Uday. Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation. And it was lovely to meet you a few weeks ago in Johannesburg. And yeah, very honored to be on here.
Yeah, we had a fantastic time together, the South African Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery. And I really enjoyed your talks, especially the stuff you did with keratoconus and CAIRS, which is C-A-I-R-S, corneal allogenic intrastromal ring segments. And the beauty is you learn this by like watching videos.
That's right. Look, I first saw it from Susan Jacob on YouTube, like really early in the piece back in like 2019. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, that's a really interesting idea because, you know, you'd sit in these cornea clinics and these keratoconic patients would come in and you'd be like, oh, your vision's really bad. And I wish that I could help you. I wish I could do something to improve it. But all you do is cross-link them. Then they'd still have bad vision. And then they go and get contact lenses because, you know, you really want to avoid doing PKs and DALKs on these patients. So when we'd done a little bit of the acrylic ring segments, but I think I probably took out more than I put in. And they'd sort of fallen out of fashion by the time I finished my fellowship. So, you know, really, you kind of didn't have any tools to help these people. We'd been pushing laser, doing, you know, the Athens protocol, you know, John Canalopoulos style, doing a PRK with some cross-linking. But I was seeing a bit of haze from some of those patients. Some patients are coming back a bit destabilized a few years later. So I was like, oh, I don't know if removing stuff from the cornea is the right way to go. You know, it's a weak, ectatic thing. We should be strengthening it. And, so then I saw Susan's video. I was like, oh, that is a really cool idea. And then just went from there, like getting on and watching some videos.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, a thin, weakened, ectatic cornea, you don't want to take away tissue. You want to add tissue.
Exactly. It makes a lot of sense because, you know, where's the problem? The problem is a loss. It's a volume loss. It's a loss of strength. And that's led to the change in shape. So, yes, laser deals with shape, but also, you know, destabilizes. And, yeah, cross-linking may kind of undo the damage we've done. But I just didn't love that idea. So I watched Susan's videos. She was using a double-bladed Trephine where she'd make the channel with a laser in the periphery of the cornea and put in this little sliver of tissue at about 250 or 300 microns. So that's a lot shallower than the acrylic ring segments, but it looked like a very straightforward and simple surgery to do. And but, you know, when she was making the segments, there was a lot of manual part to it, like using the punch and how much tissue you're putting in. And then she would like lay it out onto a Teflon block and cut it with a 15-degree blade, which look great. But, you know, I love things that are refined and delicate. I want to know exactly what I'm putting in. And I kind of like, I'm a bit lazy. I want lasers to do it. I don't want to have to do everything myself. I'm like, that looks like a learning curve and skill. You know, we have so much automation now. We've got the femtosecond lasers. So then Beta Kayat put a video, he's in Germany. He put a video on LinkedIn in 2021 doing it all with a femto. And right. I was like, that's it. I want to do this. This is awesome. So I messaged him, I messaged Susan, and they were just amazing guiding me through the first case. And I just thought like there'd be like 20 or 30 people doing it when I started, but I think I was like the second or third on the femto and then with Shadi Awad around the same time. But, you know, it's funny. You see these videos and you go, oh, yeah, everyone's doing it. You're like, oh, hang on. No, actually, I'm sort of out on an island here.
Well, that's the amazing part is like there's such incredibly bright people like Bader and like Susan who think of these great ideas. And then they're so generous with their time to just share it with the world.
Absolutely. I mean, I just found her email on the end of one of her YouTube videos. And I was like, hey, Susan, I'm Dave from Australia. You know, I kind of want to do this. And then she said, what's your WhatsApp? And then she sent me like 100 messages back and forth. And I'm like, it's like, you know, midnight or 1 a.m. there. And, you know, on the bottom of her email is like the 100 jobs that she does. I was like, so kind and supportive. I was like, Susan, I love that you're messaging me, but like maybe go to sleep and like, you know, do you see your family? Like you're giving me so much. I almost feel like I don't want to message her because she'll message me straight back and I don't want to take her time.
Well, how the world is so much smaller now. I mean, if I think back to when I first started ophthalmology, I'm a bit older than you. I finished my ophthalmology training in 2000. And at the time, you know, you didn't watch videos online. There were no videos online. And so now it's like the world is so small. You can, on your mobile phone, anywhere on the planet, on any continent, watch these videos in high def and learn.
Correct. It's amazing. I mean, I remember, like, I finished my ophthalmology training in 2017, and, you know, I grew up with, like, oh, hey, guys, look, like, watch this, like, Ahmed video. We're going to try and do this in theater today. We're going to do, like, a pupilloplasty, and, you know, let's all be like Ike, you know. And he would not know any of us, and we're such a long way away, but is could present an influence. Same with you today with cataract coach. All through our training, like, people go, oh, check out this cataract coach video, or, like, you know, these little pearls that, like, when you're in a big operating list with a boss, there's everyone listening, the patient's awake, you can't get that level of coaching or feedback. Whereas the video quality is so good, it's amazing how you can just go right down to these little details and share it in a way so broadly that, like, you know, that's what you have to go on a fellowship to do. And you'd only learn what one person could teach you on your fellowship. Whereas now you've got the whole world. If anyone who has a great idea and it gets promoted, we all get to learn from it, which is just awesome. Yeah.
Well, how do you make the first jump? So you've watched all these videos, you've emailed back and forth, but there has to be your first case.
Yeah. I have a colleague who I work with, Brendan Cronin, and he said, oh, Dave, I told him about this video. I was like, oh, man, I want to do this. And he's like, okay, that sounds really good. And then a week later he goes, Dave, I booked one. I'm like, you are not booking the surgery. This is my surgery, Brendan. I want to do this. So it was quite good. It lit a fire under me from just like, oh, I should do that at some point too. Actually, I should just get started. And a couple of days after that, I had a patient come in. He was 2200. He had post-LASIK ectasia. The other eye was pretty good, like, 20/40. And he was referred to me for a DALK. And I said, look, you know, there's this new operation and I think, you know, potentially you'd be a good candidate for it. I don't know if it'll be successful or not, but it's minimally invasive and we'll do that. And if it doesn't work out, then we go back and do the DALK and all of the things that I've done, it just goes. So there's really nothing to lose here except a little bit of cost and a bit of time and sort of trusting me. And he was like, yeah, okay, cool. He was a really crazy guy from South Africa. I was like, yeah, great, Dave. If that's something that doesn't have 16 stitches, isn't going to, you know, have as many risks, let's go for it. So, you know, there were about 15 people in theatre. Everyone came to watch. We had him in the laser room. Like, we did a dry run trying to work out how to do it with the FS200 suite. The bed doesn't move up and down in the middle on the FS200. So, like, we had to put a mattress under him. I had anaesthetist gave him a general anaesthetic. And then we realized that with the mattress under him on the bed, we couldn't fit him under the laser. His face had hit the laser. So we moved back to the middle. Six people lift him up on a sheet. We take out the mattress. We put him back down again. Finally, so the whole thing took about an hour and a half. I was like, wow, that was real. This is going to be a highly edited video when it goes to YouTube. And then so he came the next day and he was 20/30 uncorrected.
That's amazing.
He'd gained like 9 lines of vision and he'd gone, this is like my better eye now almost. And I was like, wow. Like, there was a real like light bulb moment of, oh my gosh, like I made that take 2 hours, but that's like a 15-minute operation if you're doing it slick. And this guy has just gained so much vision. We've avoided a transplant. And he was just ecstatic. I was ecstatic. And I was like, hey, by the way, you're also the first in Australia. And he's like, oh, what? I thought you'd done this. And I was like, I said it was new. He goes, well, how did you learn? I was like, oh, I watched it on YouTube. He's like, oh, okay. That's great. He goes, but like I could see and this is awesome. So he was like suddenly like over the moon about it. And then some media people got on, like that are to do with our clinic, got onto it, and it went on to the national news. And it was right before a major sporting event, and it went all around Australia, this news article. And then the next day we had about 60 of like the worst keratoconics in Australia ringers going, I want to come and see Dr. Gunn. I want to have it. I'm like, I've only done one. I don't know if it works yet. Like, I don't know. It's N equals one. Let's just, everyone slow down. Let's just, you know, take it a little bit easy. And then we just started off. And yeah, it's been an amazing sort of 4 or 5 years since we started. I think I'm up to about 180 cases now. Wow. And regularly on a list, I'll do, you know, 4 or 5 cares cases. And that'll take, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours. And the results, you know, not everyone is gaining like 9 lines of vision, but pretty much everyone gains some vision. It's just a question of how much. There's all this, you know, issues with nomograms and like how much do you put it in, where do you put it in? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what we've been working on. So Shadi Awad and Susa Jacob and I and Aylin Killick in Turkey have all been working at this sort of trying to find the way, and we all have our slightly different schools of thought, but we're all converging on the same sort of message that, look, you know, you just find a keratoconic who's got relatively moderately bad vision in one eye. The other eye, you don't want to be perfect, because if the other eye is perfect, they're always going to be comparing the bad eye to the really good eye. Right. And so they'll go, well, I've gone from really bad to like, okay, but it's still not as good as my 20/20 eye. So if one eye is like, you know, 20/40 and one eye is 20/80, they're great, because often the 20/80 will get to like 20/30 and they're like, it's my good eye now. Now you've got to do my old good eye. And then you're all high-fiving and happy. So, you know, and you don't, if you're starting on the count fingers eyes, they're going to go from count fingers to like, you know, 20/100. And they're like, oh yeah, I'm glad that like I'm seeing a line on the chart now, but like that's nothing to write home about. It's not changing my life.
Right.
So we're working out for these really mild cases, these really severe cases, like how much do you do, how much tissue do you put in, and where. So yeah, I think the support from Susan Jacob, there's a lot of videos out there now on YouTube. You know, Brendan Cronin and myself have put out a few things on our Cares Plan website to help with that. So yeah, there's a lot of resources to help surgeons start.
Well, I love how you've got the world working together. You've got Shadi Awad in Lebanon, you've got you there in Brisbane, you've got Susan Jacob in India, you've got Bader in Germany, you've got your other colleague there in Turkey. It's like, yeah, we're all coming together with the magic. Yeah. We're all going to do this.
That's right. It's really, it's actually been, you know, for me, it's been a really cool experience, because I got to meet all these international surgeons and I would never have done that. So, you know, I've been to Istanbul to sit in with Aylin Killick in theater and watch her operate. And I've been with Susan in Chennai. And like, if I hadn't sort of stepped out and done this, I would never have got all of these experiences. And you actually learn heaps more too. When you go somewhere or you have someone visiting, you actually learn so much from them coming that you kind of go, oh, when I'm like open and giving the things that I've learned, I'm actually getting back as much, if not more, sometimes from those people. So yeah, I went to Japan and visited a surgeon there as well. So, you know, and it was great just seeing how the operating theatres work. He's like, oh, yeah, this is how I do this. And I go, oh, man, that's awesome. I'm going to use that next week in theatre, you know. So it's really, it's, and this is the thing of the internet, isn't it, how we're all connected now. So, yeah.
What a lot of young ophthalmologists love this podcast, because we kind of give good insights how to kind of propel your career. What advice do you have to prepare for your first of any new case? Okay, you've watched a ton of videos over and over again. What do you do to prepare now? More specifically, like my advice was, if I'm doing a new procedure, I make actually a list. Steps that I want to do, and I will tape it to the microscope in the operating room. So if I just, I can look away like, okay, let me go through my list here, my checklist. What do you do?
Absolutely. I think that we've aligned on exactly the same thing, Uday. I think I'll have an A4 sheet of paper, and I'll write like even the most simple things that you wouldn't even think, like, yeah. Oh, you know, refill with viscoelastic, or, you know, IA to remove, like just every step. So when you're stressed, you can go, okay, where am I up to on my checklist? Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's getting a complex idea and breaking it down into really small, simple chunks and having them all written there so that you can go, okay, where am I up to? And it just takes away all that stress. I really like drawing a big circle of the eye. And I like drawing where my incisions are going to go. Like, you know, the first time you're trying a Yamani or something, or you go, oh, hang on, where was I meant to put that incision again? And you kind of look and you go, oh, yep, that's the spot on the circle on the eye. And the nurses go, oh, when we see the piece of paper out, David, we know it's going to take half an hour longer. And you make us a little bit nervous. Like you might ask us to hold a lens or something or a haptic. And I go, yeah, you know, I've got the paper out, you know. And it's what I've also do is I save those to my like hard drive and things so that when you come back like a year or two later, you go, oh, I did that thing. How did I do it?
Right.
You can go back and it's written out like super, super simply. Like, you know, oh, what was the level of prolane? Like 6.0. Okay. Oh, what forceps did I use to actually get it? Like each instrument all written down. That's just like the cookbook, isn't it? And then you go back to the video, you watch your little playlist and you go, oh, yeah, even though I haven't done that for 2 years, I can just, you know, call on that little memory. And, yeah, that's how I approach it. But And I think, you know, getting a good night's sleep, not drinking alcohol beforehand, and like,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of music in the theater. Like I know some surgeons, I think younger surgeons most operate with music now, but just having some chill tunes going And if, like, once you start, if you start getting in a bit of a hairy situation, there's a tendency to, like, speed up. And you kind of go, oh, this is stressful and I feel a bit anxious and I want this experience to stop. So I'm going to try and go quickly and take shortcuts to make it stop sooner. And that's like in your mindset. And your mindset has to go, no, just stop. Just take a breath. Just sit back from the microscope. Go, okay, take a little breath. There's no hurry. We're all good. Don't worry about what's on the end of the list. Okay, come back. All right, what am I going to do? Let's, like, make a plan. And I remember when I was on fellowship, one of my bosses said to me a really good thing, Derek Toll in Bristol. He's like, never do anything more than twice. He's like, if you've tried a maneuver twice, that's enough. Right. You're at the level of dexterity now where your technique, the angle you're holding it, the instrument you've got, your approach isn't working. Reassess, change tact. And that's always a really cool tip, I think, when you're up against that, something hasn't quite gone right, you're doing a new technique. Right. I think that mindset of, like, you know, the sixth or seventh time you're trying to grab something, you go, okay, no, hang on.
We've all been there. Yeah, I think we've all been there, because I think one of the natural human instincts is kind of denial. Like, no, it's going to work. Or you have a complication and you kind of want to not pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So you deny that it gets a little worse. So one of my pearls was, well, there's a complication and drop. I'd stabilize the eye, obviously. If you break the bag, put viscoelastic. And I just stop for a second and think, okay, take a few breaths, as you said. And now I imagine that, okay, this patient was referred to me because they had a complication elsewhere. How will I fix the complication? And it puts me in a different mindset. Instead of trying to rescue myself, I'm like, okay, how can I best help this patient?
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. That's changing it from a blame situation to a repair or a helping situation. You know, what can I do? So, yeah, look, I think that's really, I think it's important early in your career as a surgeon not to start closing down, because there's an element of going, all right, I can do this. I've been trained to do this. And now I'm presented with a new operation or a procedure. And that's a fear scenario. Like, what if it doesn't go right? What if something happens? And I think particularly when you're early in your career, you want to get in a habit of being a little bit uncomfortable, because you're not going to learn everything that you're going to learn as a trainee. You know, most of my learning, the majority has been as a consultant, and you really want to have that attitude of, okay, I want to have this lifelong learning. What's next? What's better? I want to go, like, everything can be improved. Everything can be improved. And if someone has a little thing, a new procedure, great. I mean, as long as you feel that it's safe and that it makes biological sense, hopefully there's a little bit of data around it, but getting on board with something and saying, okay, I'm going to embrace this, I think is important. Because if you start shutting down early career, you're just not going to have, I don't think it's as fulfilling. And you're always kind of going, oh, I don't know, like, am I behind or am I offering the best for my patients? So I think we've all got to get good at that, isn't it? It's part of our job, really, is like embracing change and like having a system, as you said, with how we bring those operations in and how we approach them. Yeah.
For sure. In 10 years, you're not going to do surgery the way you're doing it now. So you've got to keep evolving. You got to keep learning every day. You got to keep pushing the envelope, for sure, because it's going to keep evolving.
And the other thing that I do with my practice is I've got two types of lists. I have my high volume cataract and pterygium lists, which are just because we do so many pterygiums in Queensland. And then I have my complex Monday. And so it's Monday morning and I just have like all of my complex stuff on there. And that day, the booking times are like much longer. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows, like, all right, each case is going to be a little bit more complex, because if you're trying something new or you have like your more complex stuff in the middle of a like flowing cataract list, it breaks the flow. And then like if you have an issue and you go, you know what, actually, I would like to secure that IOL long some sort of way. I want to use some Prolene or some Gore-Tex. Yeah. That's another 20 minutes or something. But I've got like six people waiting outside for me. And then you start doing, you're making decisions based on a reason that you shouldn't. Like when you're on the operating theater, you don't want to think like that, do you? You want to be, I have all the time in the world. And so for having that like locked off, I think is kind of good. And then if you know something is going to be complicated, you don't even know what you're going to do until you're going to get in there. Like end of the list is always where I put that. So I go, I've got plenty of the morning to kind of get, I'm up to date with my skills. I'm feeling natural in the eye, you know, brushed out all the cobwebs. And then when they come in, I've got all the time. And it might be 10 minutes or it might be an hour, and that's okay. You know,
I do the same thing. Yeah, I'll book all my straightforward cases first. and then end the day with a couple of real tough cases because you're not quite sure. And then therefore, you're not under time pressure. You can just take your time, relax, do a good job.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, let me ask you about your refractive toolkit, because you talked about CARES, but we got a whole alphabet soup. We've got IC8, small aperture lenses. We've got PTK. We've got ICLs. We've got secondary IOLs. We've got CXL. I mean, what's your kind of flow chart in your mind of how to deal with these patients?
I think you know, that's really developed over the last few years. So I was like, where does CARES fit in the keratoconus visual rehabilitation model? So if patients have really good corrected vision, you know, with like two diopters of CIL, you know, they're like plus a half, minus two, and they're seeing, you know, 20/20 or 20/15, those patients in general, I just cross-link, or I might do a little bit of topographic laser with their cross-linking, just a very small amount. Once their vision is getting more like they're only correcting to 20/30 or something like that, and they, or they've got a real quality of vision issue, then pretty much from there all the way up to a central corneal scar or keratometry values of like 70 and 80 and stuff, they're like, they need graft. But that early, mid to quite severe, for me, the first step is CARES. So the first step is, okay, let's do an additive procedure. Let's try and regularize the cornea as much as we can by putting tissue in where it looks like it's needed. Then it's sort of wait. If they need cross-linking, I'll do cross-linking usually a month later. There's a bit of data around now and a bit of expert opinion, I guess, saying that cross-linking may cause some issues if done at the same time as CARES. You might get a little bit more haze from the cross-linking, or you may see a melt. So you do get melts with CARES. You know, one of the ideas of going towards CARES and away from using acrylic segments was, all, look, acrylic segments rub, you know, people are going to continue to rub their eye. We're going to get this over time, either it migrates or we start to get some stromal necrosis over the top of the channel. Oh, it's looking a bit thinner. Oh, it's going a bit gray. Oh, no, there's a melt. And that's often the time at which those segments come out. So the idea with CARES was to say, well, you know, we could have a lower risk of that if we were to go down that pathway. So that unfortunately isn't always 100% of the case. With CARES, if you put a really big segment in, if you put it in too shallow, like 200 or 150 microns, you can get a melt. The good thing is, though, if you get a melt and the CARES sort of, if the roof sort of dissolves over the top, often they'll just epithelialize. So they go through a process where the roof comes back, the epithelium grows over, and they go, yeah, I'm okay now. So it's sort of like this process, but because it's just stroma, it's just like an epithelial defect. It's not like you've got a piece of plastic which can heal the epithelium over. So, but obviously it's something that you want to avoid, but most CARES can stay in. So either way, to go back then about the algorithm. So you do CARES, cross-linking, I usually do about a month later if they need it, and then we wait. And I've found that patients continue to change for quite a while after CARES. I used to sort of say, oh, 3 months will be good. We can like decide, make the next step. But I think really you probably need to wait longer than that, maybe even 6 to 9 months, because you've made a massive change in the cornea, particularly if you're doing cross-linking as well. You're going to get this slow refractive shift that occurs between month 3 and month 12. And some people come in at month 3, they might be like 20/40, and they're still going, oh, it's okay. Like, I'm still not totally happy. I'm like, look, let's just wait. You know, and they'll come back at 12 months. Their topography will have only changed a little, but their vision has continued to improve. Mm-hmm. And there's something going on with the remodeling of the CARES within in the channel, epithelium remodeling. And often they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I've just adapted to it. I've got a new pair of glasses. And maybe instead of being 20/40, they're 20/30 or 20/25. And they're happier with it. So, you know, I definitely wait. Now, once I get to 12 months, I look at the corner topography and say, okay, are you 30? Yep. Okay. Do you want to try and improve your vision more? Yes, I do. Okay. Well, if we can refract them up, so if we can say we put up a 2 or 2.5 diopters of CIL, then they're great candidates for ICL. So you say, okay, don't touch the cornea anymore. Let's pop an ICL in to deal with your astigmatism. And they're really often really happy with that. If they're not refracting up, so you just can't get good quality vision with a refraction, then you can consider topographic laser. So you do trans PRK. The issue here is that this is a surefire way to de-roof a CARES segment. So if you just go laser, and particularly when you're treating hyperopia, you're doing a peripheral ring of laser, the first thing that the laser will start to ablate through is the roof, because the epithelium, the roof's all elevated, the epithelium is thinned on top, and you'll be about 20 microns into the trans PRK part, and boom, you can see the roof starting to ablate. So what we've started to do here in Brisbane, and I think Shadi Awa does in Lebanon too, is, you know, cutting out a little bit of a mask, you know, with like those little sponges that you use to put mitomycin C on, and basically just putting those and shielding them just on top of the CARES segment so that it limits the size of the ablation just into that central part. And really, rather than trying to correct all the refraction, we're just trying to correct the hard aberration. So on the EX500, on the WaveLight system, you know, doing contura, like topo-guided treatment, and that can be really effective. So, yeah, so that's useful when they're young. And when they're older, like 50, 55, then often we're going to refractive lens exchange, put a pinhole lens in, go, look, we've done the CARES or the Apthera IC8 in the US. So we've made your cornea a lot more regular, but it's still, it's not regular enough to have a normal IOL. Let's try and put a pinhole lens in. That's going to deal with a lot of the irregularity. There'll probably still be some astigmatism that we can come in correct later with a secondary top-up IOL, like the add-on first Q toric lens. And obviously, these aren't available in all markets, so it might be that you're going more for a laser procedure to deal with the astigmatism, or, you know, maybe you're putting an ICL in the sulcus, or, you know, depending on what you have available to you. But I find that to be a really helpful thing. In terms of, like, picking the lens after CARES, it's complex. It's like, you know, when you've got a keratoconic and you're trying to work out how to target their astigmatism, it's just you get these unexpected results. So I think going for a monofocal rather than an astigmatic correcting lens is safer if there's a lot of astigmatism, but it's pretty regular. Yeah, you go, look, I may not correct all the seal, but maybe I'll try and correct 2/3 of it, and I know the axis is going to be about right. Look, their uncorrected vision is going to be a lot better. Yeah, they'll still need glasses. And I think this is all the expectation setting. It's saying to patients, look, you're going to need potentially CARES, but then potentially multiple steps afterwards. And with each step, it's kind of like we build the foundation, then we're going to build the frame of the house, then we're going to put the walls on the roof, and you can't expect to move in when the foundation's just built. But some people, that'll be enough, you know. So that's and, you know, and it's going to be a step, and you're going to wait 12 months. And, you know, so you're kind of joining me on this journey. You've got a complex, sick eye. There hasn't been a really good treatment for this until now, but it takes time. And so, you know, people kind of go, oh, I'm going to go see the guy. I'm going to go fly and see Dave. He's going to fix me. I'm like, all right, hey, steady on there, buddy. Like, all right, you know, just have a bit of chill, just relax. Okay, we're going to do this first. We'll see where we land. And always do the worst eye first. And then it's very helpful to see what the first eye did as the second eye, because if you have an undercorrection, you can increase 30, 40% what you put in. If you have an overcorrection, you can put less. And age of the patient definitely affects it. If they've had cross-linking, you know, they have a significant less effect. So I increase on my nomogram 25 or 30% if they've had cross-linking. So you can see there's a bit more of an art than a science. It's a good combination of the two here. And that's where I think having these automated nomograms and systems that we're developing is just going to make this so much easier, you know.
Absolutely. No, I love that approach for it. Now, you also mentioned about your big OR days. Not your Mondays were the challenging cases, but your other day, your Thursdays, I think, where you're knocking out a bunch of routine cataracts. How do you go from, in your training, you're doing a modest number of cases? Like in Los Angeles, UCLA, when I taught residents, a good resident would do like 10 cataracts in a day. But now you'll be in practice and you may be doing 40.
Yeah. So I would normally do between 36 and 43, something like that, depending on the day. And yeah, so I've never pursued speed. I think pursuing speed is dangerous, you know. And but I also pursue like removing steps that are unnecessary and cutting out dead time and cutting out movements or inefficiencies, like with a bit of a passion. So each list going, okay, you know, last time I did the Rexus with like 7 grabs. Okay, now I'm going to try and do 6 grabs. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to try and do 4 grabs. Now I do 3, you know, and each time you're doing it going, all right, I'm just concentrating on that one step, getting that a bit slicker and slicker. And each list go, all right, I'm just going to have that one thing all day and I'm going to work on it and just get it better. And it's just that constant attitude of self-improvement, I think, and not doing that, what's happening today? Oh, yeah, just doing my standard cataract and, oh, that's just the standard thing for me. I'm still, like, it's been 8 or 9 years now of me in my practice and I'm still trying things. Like, you know, when you brought out that 2-minute FACO video from, like, that guy in South America, I was like,
yeah, never. Okay, Amazing guy.
I thought I was getting quite good. But clearly I could be a lot better. And it's not about the time at all. It's just
he's so efficient. He's really efficient.
The confidence of movements and the just knowing there is an envelope in which I can move my hands safely. And as long as I'm in that envelope and I can navigate that envelope quickly, that's fine. And I know that I can't go outside that envelope. And it's being so comfortable in that range that that's where I can go. And, oh, fantastic. So I think that's part of it. Part of it, too, is culture, I think. You know, I think you mentioned this in one of your I remember hearing one of your talks, and you were saying about, you know, the surgeons at the place you're working were like, he's lying. He can't be going that quick. Like, we want to see his videos. He must just be like this risky, bad surgeon, you know, when you first started today. And like, and they came watching. It was like, oh, no, okay, no, he's fine. It's just that if there's a culture in the building of we're not pursuing efficiency, or we're not, you know, we're not wanting to move forward and change and adapt, like, okay, oh, the nurses go to the microscope and they can load up the patient for me and they can pick, you know, check that, and they can have the lens sitting out there for me to check, as opposed to, you know, 20 times a day going over and doing that one step. And you go, well, actually, I don't need to do that step. I have this set of skills, and anything outside of that, I'm not trying to be lazy or like push people around, but you go, we're here to achieve an outcome. And it's good for this hospital and it's good for me if I achieve that outcome, you know, efficiently. And there are a lot of staff here that are here to support me. And any of those sort of tasks that I can hand off to them is a beneficial thing. So obviously I'm still checking the patient's eye. I'm checking their name. I'm like checking, okay, right eye, right patient, look at the consent form, look at the microscope, looking at the lens myself, checking off the EQ workplace with Zeiss. That's the lens, good. You know, there's things that wouldn't feel comfortable. Like, I don't want to come into a draped patient completely already. I can't see them. I can't really see which eye I'm on. The lens is already that much. Like, I just would feel uncomfortable with that. But there are a lot of things that, you know, do you need to go to the computer and like read the notes before every cataract? I don't think you probably do. I think that most cataracts for most surgeons, it's sort of pretty routine. And you may change things slightly with each case, but most of that's going to appear intraoperatively. If I have patients who are like, they have a problem, like, oh, yeah, they've got, you know, on tamsulosin, or they've got, you know, pseudoexfoliation syndrome, on the consent form, I just put star PXF or star post-trauma. And so when we're in theatre, we're at the consent form, they go, oh, patient has Fuchs dystrophy. I'm like, cool, thank you. And I mean, that's about all you need to know, isn't it? I don't write only eye on patients. I don't like to know. I think if it's only eye, I like to just want to be automatic, but sometimes I do. But you know, I think going through in your mind, being really that continuing that self-reflection even after you're a consultant, and saying, okay, what am I doing each day? What am I changing every 3 to 6 months? How can I improve those things? And then speed just comes naturally, I think. Look, comfortably now, we have two operating theatres going. I'll have one anaesthetist and two nursing teams, because there's some things that you can't speed up, like how long does the Centurion take to prime? How long does it take to open all that kit? And in Australia, with our day hospital rules, you can't have like two patients' stuff open in the same theatre. The patient has to have left. Everything has to be removed. The theatre has to be cleaned before you can start opening for the next one. So some places will like have, they wheel in a trolley that's already open, but they still have to set up the Callisto and they still have to set up the Centurion. So all of those things, you know, if you times that by 20 or 25, that you're losing, you know, 2 hours of the day. So basically what I do is I come in, we set up for the patient, I'll do the surgery, I'll remove the speculum, and then basically I walk out to the next theatre and they're ready to go and do the same thing again. I write all my notes at the end of the day. I don't write them in between cases because I think that stopping and starting all day really slows you down. And there's like a really nice rhythm to it. It doesn't feel at all like hard work. I'm not rushing, but, you know, comfortably we can do, you know, between 6 and 8 cataracts an hour with that system. And the nurses aren't stressed, because if you've got like one team of nurses trying to push through 7 cataracts an hour in a single theatre, they're running, they're unhappy, they're like... Like life's a marathon, not a sprint, you know. And for me, my bit's easy because I'm in my rhythm of like doing surgery. And it's funny. And as those years go past, I think year 2, 3, 4, and getting into year 5 and 6, you're just getting really, really comfortable with cataract surgery. And most of the time it's pretty smooth sailing, isn't it? And, you know, yeah, so that's been my approach. And I think it's just encouraging people to look at what they're doing and trying to maximize their time, because the more time you're there in theater, like really, you've only got so much of your time in your life, don't you? And your life force energy to give. And if you're sitting in theater, like, you know, waiting all day, it just sucks.
Very important points. I think I agree with you with it being in the state of flow. When you're in that state of flow, it's just, it's not work. It's not, it's just fun. You're just really enjoying every case. You're so focused. And that's also the important thing about the teamwork. It's all about the team. Cataract surgery is not a solo sport. You need the entire team. And I also, like you said, you've got to delegate things that you other people can do. Let them do it. But there are certain things that only you can do. Only you are going to make the decision to do the Rex and take the phaco. So no one else can do that. But certainly the other little things, setting up the scope, or that can easily be delegated.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the other little thing I like is having two. You've got your one MacBook and you set up MIDI so that you can have two speakers going in each theater and you have the same music going in each theater. And it's really nice because you just kind of like that song's continuing and you come back and that song's continuing. And so I've been working hard on my theater playlists. I've got this great Spotify operating list. David Gunn, look it up, guys. You're welcome. Increase my Spotify playlist followers. I'll have like a wedding playlist, you know. You've got a little bit upbeat. Can't be too down, you know. Can't have too many swear words for some of the Filipino nurses that are in theater. It'd be offended. So we have to have it like nice.
I'll look your playlist up on Spotify then. David Gunn playlist, operating playlist.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny? I actually operate. I don't like any music. I like it quiet. I'm maybe the exception here, but I like it quiet. I think it's just easier for me. I just stay better focused. I'm just kind of, that's how I get into my zone. But probably has a lot of my upbringing. My parents didn't believe in, like, after school, we would just go to the library until like 7 or 8 o'clock at night where they'd pick us up. So I'm just spending the entire afternoon in the library.
Oh, that's good. I think the other thing you need is you need a good, this isn't so much in the US, but in Australia, we have an anaesthetist there. So all of my patients are heavily sedated. They're sort of snoring.
To what degree?
Propofol and midazolam, and we just do topical. So we have topical and sedation. There's no blocks. They just have a bit of xylocaine gel beforehand, then a few drops of oxybuprocaine. They come in with a drip in, and they're sedated, and then we have their head taped to the bed, and just to stop them from moving. And most don't because they're just sleepy, and with most cases that's fine. So, and that really helps with the flow and also helps with the recovery, because patients go to recovery, they've just got a clear shield on their eye. There's no pad, you know, that, so there's no bruising, there's no retrobulbar, peribulbar issues, there's no subtenons like red eye. And it's funny, you know, it's like the surgeons say, you know, the patients only see one thing, it's the scar or the dressing. So they've got to make the dressing really nice. So when they have a white eye, there's no swelling, there's no block stuff. And when they're driving home and they can already read their phone from their multifocal lens, they're like, oh, wow. You know, it's that real, you get that real wow factor with topical that you don't really get with a block. And not that should matter, but it's a nice side effect. So I've got a really good anaesthetist who's very good at sort of managing that little bit of sedation, but being able to keep the pace up as well. And we do a lot of videos, like before the patient comes, they get a little video from the anaesthetist going, hi, you know, I'm Dr. So-and-so. And, you know, so they see his face beforehand and this is what's going to happen today. This is what to expect. You know, you're going to have a drip. You're going to be asleep for the surgery. You know, you may not remember seeing Dr. Gunn. You're going to be heavily sedated. And, you know, these are the small risks of an anaesthetic. Some people might feel a bit sick when they wake up. That's great. It really helps.
It's so interesting. I do something similar, but not nearly as heavy. So I'm obviously doing, for the last 20 years, all topical anesthesia as well. I just do tetracaine topically because I don't want the gel on the eye, because what if it's trapping some bacteria? So I just do. And then sedation-wise, I use an anesthesiologist as well, and she usually gives 1 or 2 milligrams of midazolam. That's it. So we don't do any propofol. I haven't had a case of propofol in like years. And so it's actually very interesting. We do it a little differently. And then after the case, I actually, instead of putting a shield over the eye, I give them sunglasses. I buy these sunglasses in bulk and put the sunglasses on them and say, okay, there you go, you're done.
That's awesome. Because, I mean, I guess, you know, do you really need a shield? I think, you know, they're going home at night, they go to sleep, they're going to rub their eye at night. Well, the wound is so small, it's unlikely, isn't it? I mean, they're probably fine. We still do the shield at night for a week, but it's probably overkill.
You know? Nah, I haven't done the shield at night for 20 years.
Yeah, you go. Amazing. So,
you know, listen, you're making this 2.2, 2.4 millimeter incision. You're making it a valve shape. You know, think about it. If you push on the eye, it closes the incision. It doesn't open it.
Very true. Yeah. And you know, when you try and burp a wound, it's quite hard. You've got to like go, oh, I've got to really get this. And you're trying to do it. So it's not that easy.
Yeah. So knock on wood, I've had zero issues in I don't know how many tens of thousands of cases.
I like that. I might change that. Yeah. Look, I think we give about 6 or 7 mils of propofol. And, you know, it's a fair bit. But patients, if you asked a patient, would you rather be awake or asleep? A lot of patients would say asleep.
But you know what? The midazolam, yeah. The midazolam is so effective.
Yeah.
So my patient usually get like a half milligram as we're wheeling, as they're being wheeled into the operating room. When yeah. I enter the operating room, they get another half milligram. And if they need more, they get another milligram during the case. But that causes such great retrograde amnesia. You ask the patient and they say, they don't remember anything. They said, all I remember is to look at the light. Then the nurse says, time to go home.
Yeah, that's good. Do they talk to you today? Do they kind of go, oh, hey, Dr. Dave Garn, you know?
Rarely. I'd say only a couple percent maybe. And those who do, I just say, okay, this is quiet time right now. Just look at the light. Look at the pretty lights.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, a lot of people talk about centering the IOL on the first Purkinje and all this sort of stuff. You can't do that when they're on propofol because they're just sort of like, oh, you know, there's zero fixations. I don't know if I believe in that, but, you know, anyway. But, yeah, it's an interesting idea. And, yeah, they tell you what, the recovery would be much happier if they all came out more awake because they come out often quite asleep going, come on, time to wake up. Dr. Gunn's all finished.
It's easy for us to get them, you know, back on their feet, get them going.
It's funny because a little bit is dangerous because they have a little bit, then they start getting disinhibited and like going a bit, oh, what's that? Whereas when they're heavy, they're beyond that point. So it's sort of almost like you need to have nothing or quite a bit. It's that in-between zone where they, you know, throw their head towards you or hear a noise and jump or something, you know. Yeah. And
we also tape the head down. Paper, two inch, or you'd say 5 centimeter paper tape.
Yeah,
on the forehead.
We do the we actually do the hands as well. We do a little we call them the rainbow bands of safety. So that's just to, you know, because when they have the propofol, you know, they often want to scratch their nose, so they're sort of coming up. You know, and they're just like, we don't use tape. We just use the anesthetic bands. You know, they would use to draw blood. So we just put them down, and as soon as the patient's finished, we just click the button, and they're all good to go. They're like, why can't I move my hand? Oh, it's just a little safety support there, you know. So
if you're a young ophthalmologist listening, I think one thing I can really encourage you to do is collect data. So one thing I used to do with my residents is I'd have them mark every case, write down on a sheet, what's the time in the room? When was your timeout done? If you're a resident doing a block, when was the block done? Write down the time of the first incision, write down the end of the case when the drapes come off, and then write down when you were out of the room. And this will show you where your roadblocks are. And for most resident cases, you can do more cases per day by keeping your cut time identical, but getting the nonsense slacker. We had residents where they were surprised to realize that from the time they're in the room to the first incision was like 20 minutes. What are you doing?
It blows your mind, doesn't it? Because you know that health costs are going up so much. You know, it's costing so much to deliver healthcare. That we just, you've got to have, the theater is so expensive to provide and all the stuff. It just has to be used efficiently. You know, it's our responsibility as surgeons to pursue that. And you don't need 20 minutes to go through all the notes and the scans and recheck, you know, I'm going to re-go through the biometry again. And there's just no value in doing that on the day. That's all before the day of surgery. Yeah.
Give us some first, how do you get your whole OR team, even your clinic team, kind of on the same page with the same focus, like the people skills?
Yeah, look, I think it's that's the challenge, isn't it? It's all very well for you to want to do something, but you need to have that supportive team around you. And you almost feel like, particularly these kind of changes, you feel a bit guilty sometimes, or you feel a bit bad because, you know, particularly for us, we're on a fee-for-service basis, so we get paid more if we do more, whereas a lot of the other team don't. They get paid an hourly wage and, yeah, they want to support you. But if they're like running around all day versus just calmly doing their work, it's a challenge, you know, for motivating those people. So I think rather than going on the line of, you know, we want to do more work, we want to do more cataracts, I think it's more just like, oh, step by step, building efficiency and involving people in the process. So asking them, go, guys, you know, are there any things that you think that we could do differently or improve, to, you know, our efficiency to sort of like to make the day flow a bit quicker? So, you know, we're all going home on time. We're not sort of left late in the day. Are there things that I can do or the thing that you can do that we can improve it? And sort of having that discussion, they get a bit of buy-in in it and go, what do you think about these packs and these instruments? Are you happy with them? Like, what do you think of the preloaded lenses? You know, do you prefer them? Is there things that I can help with that? Unfortunately, as well, there's a bit of, oh, okay, this is what's going to happen. A little bit, isn't it? You go, there's a bit of that too, going, okay, guys, well, look, you know, this is what we're going to try today. We're going to try and slow change, you know. Don't try and change 10 things at once. Okay, today you guys are going to, can you, you know, load the Callisto for each patient for me in the microscope? Great. You know, leave it a week. Okay, cool. All right, the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, how's that going? Do you guys have any trouble with that? You know, do you understand? Everyone know how to do it? Cool. Awesome. Okay. All right, look, why don't we try something else today? Like maybe you guys could change the microscope around for me so it's all set up for the case. Cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, and then bit by bit by bit, suddenly you kind of go, all right, things are kind of getting done. This is where two theaters is really nice because you're not there for half the time. And so they have half the time to kind of get ready. And they have that feeling of when the doctor's in the room, we're here to kind of help this bit happen. Right. And then he's out and we get our time to kind of reset and kind of get everything ready and stuff. So that's been very helpful for me improving efficiency because I'm like, okay, well, and also like playing the teams off against each other. Well, you know, I'm in the A team here, guys. Are you guys going to be the B team today? Like, you know? And I always like, you know, we you know, buy the nurses coffee. We always stop for morning tea. We always stop for lunch. You don't start like increasing efficiency by cutting breaks. You don't increase your numbers by making the list run late. You go, I want to be finished 15, 20 minutes before the end of the theater. I want to be out of here. I'm not the here at 6:30 p.m. where everyone's asking to stay late. You don't want to be that doctor because none of the team in their heart of hearts, they don't really love that doctor. You know, they want to go home. They want to be with their family. They don't want the overtime. Like they've been in this job for 20 years. Mm. They just have a nice day, have fun. Have a nice environment, you know, and I think I understand for you, not Uday, but I think for other surgeons, like nurses love music in theatre too. It's like when you're listening to music and then you kind of talk about the song and sometimes you go, oh, turn this one up, and there's a bit of a like a, we're having fun together. It's not a party, but it's like we're in this cool environment. We're talking about our weekend a little bit or a little, you know, not tons of that, but you need to have that feeling of a bit of warmth and I think music definitely helps with that vibe. It helps the nurse because patients don't hear it; they're asleep. So,
that's true. Mine are a little different. Patients aren't that deep for me, but I think the important thing is, you know, we learn how to be ophthalmologists, so we wear the ophthalmologist hat very well. But no one teaches us how to wear like the manager hat.
Yeah,
that's the hard part. You kind of have to pick it up on your own.
It's a real challenge. I mean, I think, and this is that whole people doing the personality tests and things and understanding what their personality is, what their motivators are. And then that either gives them strengths or weaknesses as a leader. Like, so I realized that I'm a people pleaser. I was always a people pleaser with my mum and dad. And that was good for me at school because I wanted to please my teacher and I wanted to get good marks. And, it made me a good trainee because I want to make my boss happy and I got good cases. But then you come into being a manager and, like, you can't always be a people pleaser and have staff. And, like, how do you motivate staff? But also sometimes there's hard conversations you have to have. And if you're always just trying to make people happy and want people to like you, it's a difficult thing. So, you know, learning those kind of communication skills, I think, is really important. You know, going and doing courses, and there's, you know, the World College of Vision and Refractive Surgery, you know, what used to be the Refractive Surgery Alliance, they have lots of these like great resources and things, and like quite good meetings. There's ophthalpreneurs meeting now as well in Europe. Well, I haven't been to it, but like, it sounds like they have really great content for, you know, when you finish as a doctor, when you own your own clinic, and then how do you manage that? How do you manage people? How do you kind of deal with all these other bits around you that aren't surgical? And, I don't think I've mastered that at all. I'm lucky that I've got a few people around me, like Brendan, who I work with. He's just like an awesome people person. And I go, oh, Brendan, I don't know what to do. And he's like, it's okay, Dave. I'll sort this out. You know, so, you know, realizing when you're getting a great practice manager or having good partners and kind of knowing where you're strong and where you're weak and what you bring to the table and what other people can help you with, I think is so important.
Well, I like your idea also of kind of baby steps. Don't come in one day and say, today we're changing these 12 things. That's a sure recipe for disaster. Come That's in and right. just say, let's just change one thing this week. And then next week, maybe one other thing. And slowly over the course of a couple of months, now you've incorporated all the 12 things you wanted, but it was a nice gradual kind of process with baby steps. I think that is so important.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's good for you. It's good for the team. And I mean, change is scary for anyone, I think. And the nurses particularly, they, you know, they've probably been through times where cases are difficult and where everyone's stressed or they're blamed for things if they don't go right. So they're a bit scared of change. So you've kind of got to be the, you know, the one guiding and leading and getting them excited about it. And as you said, just like little spoons, you know, not the big spoon that choke on.
Right, the little baby steps help. And then finally, I mean, my biggest pearl for a young surgeon, if you're just starting your practice, or even you're a resident or fellow, come to the OR or operating theater early. I get there 1 hour before my cut time because I can just relax. If there was traffic or I had a flat tire, even it's okay. I'll still be there on time. I get there, I set up the scope myself, I get my recording media going, I just, it's so much more relaxed that way. Don't be the doctor who's chronically 15 minutes late. Like,
guilty.
Oh, no, don't ever do that. Don't listen to Dr. Gunn here.
No, but I know what you're saying. It's like when you're running, you know, I don't know if you play golf, but if you're late for golf and you're rushing from theater to get to golf, and you get to the tee and everyone's waiting for you 5 minutes late, the next group's watching you, you're not going to hit a good tee shot. You know, anxiety and good performance do not go together. You've got to be cool, calm and collected to perform at your best and to be in the right state of mind. I agree completely, you know.
Yeah, I just like it super early. And I also operate very, very early. LA has terrible traffic, probably magnitude worse than Brisbane. Brisbane's got traffic too.
But I'm at work in 10 minutes from my door. I'm in the OR in 15. So I'm not leaving the house at the time when the OR list starts, but hopefully 10, 15 minutes.
But I think, you know, my staff also loves it. So I actually get there at 5 a.m. I start cutting at 5:45 to 6 a.m. And if I start at 5:45, our whole day is done by about 1 o'clock.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then so they love it because none of my staff work in the surgery center. They don't live in Beverly Hills. I don't live in Beverly Hills. I can't afford to live in Beverly Hills. So what we do is we commute in and there's no traffic at 5 in the morning. We do all our cases. And when we leave the city at 1 p.m. to go home, there's no traffic again.
That's right.
Yep. And they can pick up their kids from school and they can still have the whole afternoon free. People love it.
Yeah. Like I said, you've got to, and people appreciate when you look after them and you make the environment where like their needs are important, you know? And I think that's it. Like, traffic is just dead time, isn't it? I think that's a great approach, Udo. Yeah, really good.
I mean, we've been talking for almost an hour, but I want to touch on one last thing, which is a challenge that we all go through, which is the whole work-life balance thing. You have now 3 kids starting or in high school. That's stress.
Yeah, that's it. So I've got a 12-year-old, an 11-year-old, and an 8-year-old girl. So 3 girls.
High school, yeah.
And, you know, it's full on, Udo. So I think, you know, particularly with this CARES stuff, there's always it's kind of cool right now. CARES is kind of cool. And so I'm getting a lot of invitations to go and speak and stuff and trying to manage that with my wife and my family. And, oh, look, it's hard, isn't it? Because you're kind of not very busy early in your life. Then school kind of gets busier. And you finish uni and then you start working and suddenly it's all happening at once. There's family. There's your health. There is, you know, performing at work and then all the extra stuff, you know. And I don't quite know what the answer is here. I think a lot of ophthalmologists don't get it right. You know, a lot of my mentors have had, you know, difficult things happen to them and they've got things out of balance either with their health or with their family. And yeah, I definitely don't know the answer to this yet, but I'm trying to, like, this year, it's always that New Year's resolution, isn't it? To try and say no to more things, try and get a bit more balance. I it's good seeing you at in Johannesburg, like on the weights machine, working out, going, you know what? I realize in this part of my life, I've got to really look after my body. I'm loving life. I want to keep it going. I've got to, and then for me, I'm like, on my list of priorities, health has been a bit of a lower one. And it's like, yeah, hang on. I've got to refix those priorities this year. And then they slip and move. And, you know, it's always a balance, isn't it? It's one of the challenges, I think, for us. It's not just work, it's all the other parts of our life.
Absolutely. I think 40s was a really tough decade. I'm happy that I hit the 50 mark already, because the 40s, the challenge is now your clinic is really busy. When you're 1 year into your practice, it's not that busy. You got a lot of free time. But now you're 6, 8, 10 years into your practice. It's super busy. Your kids now are older and need more attention, and that's a lot more work. And then to top it all off, now you become presbyopic. Now you're like, what? I can't win.
It's just, so I'm 43 and it's just hitting me like a brick wall. Like, oh, my phone, it's going.
Right.
But I mean, it's also, I mean, I'm enjoying this part of my life more than I've enjoyed any other part. I think I'm just having the best time. I kind of, in some ways, I wish I could just pause it right now and just keep this bit going for a while, because it's really good. All right. You gave that talk at Johannesburg about the ups and downs of life, right, and you know, all those bits. And I'm on an up bit right now, and I'm like, yay, I'm enjoying the top of the roller coaster. And so, hopefully can keep it going as long as possible. But yeah, I think it's cool talking to people in different phases, like talking to yourself about, all the different things and parts of your life. It's cool as a younger, not that much younger, but you're a bit further down the track, and seeing how you've dealt with that and things that you've worked out are important, how you're managing those things. And you go, oh yeah, I had that issue. I saw that 10, 15 years ago. This is what I do now. And that's solved that for me, So keeping those connections with like mentor type of people, I think is so beneficial for those early surgeons as they're getting busier, finding people in their practice or, even friends outside of work. But there's something really special about other older ophthalmologists that you can learn so much from, and reaching out to people at conferences and meeting these people and talking about like your life. I think there's a lot of benefit to that. You don't want to be in like a silo. I think if you're in a silo, you can get off base, so.
Absolutely. Yeah, my talk in South Africa, we had a very interesting format, because we had one session of everyone gets like 3 or 4 minutes, talk about some good pearl for life. And my pearl is basically, I've realized now in hindsight that life is basically a zero-sum game. So if you're really riding high, if everything's amazing, please enjoy as much as you can now, because the tough times are around the corner. They're coming. And if you're down in the dumps right now and you're really struggling, hang in there. The good times are coming up soon. Yep. So, but at the end, it's all the roller coaster. You end where you start, basically zero sum.
I love that, Yeah, it's a great way of looking at it. Yeah. And when you're having a bad time going, things are going to improve. Just hold on. That's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've been through crazy. You know what the crazy part too is? We all have these crazy ups and downs in life, in different aspects of our life. But yeah, in retrospect, like, it worked out.
It's pretty good.
Anyway, it was a fantastic time. We've been talking for an hour. It just goes by like that, I tell you.
Thank you, Uday. It's been amazing.
Well, thank you. This was a master class in learning all about keratoconus and cares, what you're doing. I loved your pearls about being efficient in the operating room, the way you schedule things, the way you work with your team. And finally, the managerial work you do and kind of getting your team together. This was so helpful. I hope a lot of young ophthalmologists find this very helpful.
Thank you, Uday. It's been great to talk to you, and yeah, lovely to meet you. I'm sure I'll see you very soon at one of the meetings, and keep doing what you're doing. I love your podcast. Your focus on education and things, it's just amazing, and it helps so many people. And I don't think you realize how many people are affected by what you're doing here. So yeah, thank you for involving me in it.
Oh, my pleasure. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, get a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. And where you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Oh, and remember, speaking of Spotify, we got to get the David Gunn Operating Room playlist. And, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. And also check out our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com, where we have retina surgical videos and a retina podcast. So until next time, I'll catch you later.